Okay, Matthew chapter 10. Yeah, you know, we really don't have a really good timeline into Matthew like we do in John. The other Gospels just don't do a good job describing for us when, within the ministry of Christ, a lot of these events took place. Where in John's Gospel, he actually tells us when there are feasts or when there are Passover feasts. And you count the feasts in John and actually see how many years into the ministry of Christ he is with a good approximation, except that the second half of John, the whole last 13 chapters, I think, or 11 chapters of his gospel, all took place in a period of just 2 or 3 days, their crucifixion. Those first chapters of John, we could see a timeline in his narrative that we don't have in Matthew. This is evidently still at the very beginning of the ministry of Christ, after the 40 days in the desert, and then the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 9, Matthew himself was chosen by Christ and told to follow me, and he did. Now, as chapter 10 begins, Christ is wanting to send his students out. So they must have had a certain amount of learning from him. They must have heard him for some significant amount of time. And now Matthew is one of the 12 whom he had chosen, who would end up being his apostles. So it might be a year between Matthew chapter 9 and Matthew chapter 10. It might be 3 months. We're never going to know. It's always going to be difficult to try to figure that out, because these synoptic gospels just don't have the timeline built into them that the Apostle John wrote into his own gospel. So with that, we can move on to Matthew chapter 10. It must be some significant amount of time for Matthew to have learned enough from Christ and these others, of course, to be one of the 12 and to be sent out with this peculiar commission that they are going to receive at the beginning of this chapter. That's all I have to say, really.
In summoning 12 of his students, he had given to them authority over unclean spirits so as to cast them out and to heal every disease and every weakness. Now these are the names of the 12 ambassadors. First, Simon, who is called Petros, and Andreas his brother, and Jacobos the son of Zebedeus, and Johannes his brother, Philippos and Bartholomeos, Thomas and Matthäus the tax collector, Jacobos the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrays him. Do you want to talk about this list, Phil?
We can talk about the list a bit. I'm not picking on you, but I also want to talk about the pronunciation a bit.
Yeah, I likely suck. I know.
No, yeah, you don't suck. You do great, man. Believe me, you do great. But that O's at the end, to me, it's probably a short O.
Yeah. Neo, so I'm aware
because
of that.
It comes from an Omicron.
Right.
Rather than being a long O, which is an omega, and the short O, you could see that when these words are transitioned from Latin from Greek into Latin, that short O becomes a U in the spelling.
Yeah. Sometimes, like the diphthongs, I sort of like I know how the diphthongs are pronounced, but sometimes I just get in a bad habit because to me it just sounds better. But
Well, I can't ever say I'm 100% right about pronunciation because, yeah, I mean, people that have been studying Greek for 20 years in universities can't be sure about pronunciation. I follow Strong's pronunciation guide, or I try to, because to me, it just makes the most sense. I mean, I did study that for quite a bit in my early years of studying Greek, and Strong's pronunciation guide is the most sensible one I've seen.
Like, these are not omegas, so it'd be os.
Yeah, I would say Philippus and Bartholomeus and Thomas and Matthias. Jacobus, Alphaeus, Thaddeus. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
I'm not really picking on you. I know they're not Omegas, I know, but I don't know. I think it sounds better, but I likely shouldn't do that because I don't want to give people the wrong impression, I guess.
But you know what? Even when I read Petrus, I say Petrus.
Yeah, like it sounds better, doesn't it? It just sounds better to me.
Man, hey, this is way above my head.
What version we're reading from here? Is this Christian?
This is the Christogenia. This is the Christogenia New Testament, Rick. So okay. This is Bill's translation of the New Testament, and he has translation notes on the site with the commentaries, and you can read it there for free. And you can
get a physical copy
if you ever want one.
I'll place a link here in the forum beneath.
Okay, I'm just curious. I'm looking at the King James here. Thank you.
The most interesting
page with my translation of Matthew. It's all on one page. And here's another web page on my website with my commentary on Matthew chapter 10, which is where we are now. David, I'm sorry. I had it ready, man.
No problem.
I don't think I'll ever get these pronunciations right because I'm not as articulate as Bill and Noble.
Well, they didn't speak Australian, so.
So I can just blame the accent.
I was just going to say that David beat me to that, so.
Okay, Noble, you going to continue?
Well, do we want to talk about the list here? Because there's Thaddeus.
We should talk about this list.
And Cananean is also important. Too.
It is, but in the let me get my NA27 out maybe for this. In the King James version, it says Simon the Canaanite, which is like, to me that would be absolutely horrible, right? But Simon clearly wasn't Christ said, "If I was chosen 12, and one of you was a devil," and he was talking about Judas Iscariot. If Simon was a Canaanite, he'd have to say one of you is a devil and another one is a dog, or something, or maybe two of you were devils. It's Simon in the manuscripts. I want to actually find. I got it, but I want to actually, yeah. In the Codex Sinaiticus, which is usually a much more reliable codex, and in a Washingtonensis here. Which is a fifth, even though it has a name, Washingtonensis, that's only a reference to where it's stored. The codex happens to be in Washington, D.C. It's from the 5th century. It's esteemed to be from the 5th century. So it's just as old as the Alexandrinus is. Where the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus, they're esteemed to be from the 4th century. Those dates aren't guaranteed, but they're generally accepted among scholars of ancient manuscripts and papyri, right? So in the Sinaiticus and the Washingtonensis, that's a 4th and a 5th century manuscript. It has Canaanites, rather than Canaanian or Canaanahius, Canaanaios. It has Canaanitas, right? So that's the difference, is only those last couple of letters. But it's a huge difference because a Canaanite is one of the accursed people of the Old Testament. And somebody that's a Canaanahius is a person of a town called Cana, which is in Galilee, which is where Christ attended the wedding feast.
And it's where Nathaniel was from, too.
In John chapter 2, right. So there's a relationship with Christ and the apostles with the town of Cana. So it makes much more sense that Simon is a Canaan, Canaanahius. He's a man of that town, Cana, which is what that would mean. So that word is found in the Codex Vaticanus, which is from the 4th century, and the Codex Ephraemiseri, which is from the 6th or 5th centuries, the Codex Bezae, which is from the 5th century. So what we have is we have a minority of manuscripts that have Canaanite and a few more on the other side that have Canaanian or man of Cana. So in the context of the gospel itself, where Canaanites have always been rejected by Yahweh, they've always been cursed, that does not change. The Canaanite woman in Matthew chapter 15 was called a dog by Christ. That does not change. He's not going to choose a Canaanite to be an apostle. And it makes much more sense, since the apostles had a connection with the town of Cana, that this Simon was from the town of Cana. And all the conflict disappears, and we'd have to roll with it. Those manuscripts that have Canaanian and not Canaanite. This is also in Mark chapter 3, verse 18. And it's been a whole long time since I've addressed this subject. Actually, probably about 11 years, so, or 13 years since I've done my Mark commentary and Matthew commentary. Mark 3:18. Simon the Canaanian is in the text, and in Mark 3, it says Canaanite in the Codex Alexandrinus. Now, that's a 5th century manuscript, but evidently there's no reading of that verse in Matthew chapter 10. That verse might be wanting in the Alexandrinus. I could go check on that, but it's not really timely to do right now. I could try. So the Codex Alexandrinus probably doesn't have this verse in Matthew.
Well, while you check that, Bill, we can mention that Judas is the man from Kerioth, which was an Edomite city, wasn't it?
Yes. Let me just say that the Codex Alexandrinus is missing from Matthew chapter 1 all the way to Matthew chapter 25, verse 6. So that's why we don't have a reading of this passage in the Codex Alexandrinus. But in Mark, the Codex Alexandrinus has Canaanite for Simon, and the Codex Sinaiticus that has Canaanite in Matthew has Canaanian in Mark. So it's divided against itself, right? And the Codex Vaticanus, the Codex Ephraemi Syri, the Codex Bezae all have Canaanian in Mark of this Simon. But the Codex Washingtonensis is also divided against itself. It doesn't have Canaanite, it has Canaanian. So there you have it. I mean, even the manuscripts that have Canaanite for this Simon in Matthew, they all have Canaanian in Mark, but some other manuscript, the Alexandrinus, has Canaanite where it's missing in Matthew. Now, in Luke, we don't have the issue, but it's almost absolutely positive that Simon the Canaanian is Simon called Zelotes or the Zealot in Luke 6:15. And there's a lot of foolish theologians, Bible students, pastors, whatever you have, commentators, whatever you want to call them, who think for that reason that Canaanite translates to zealot. And that's just straight fabrication.
Yeah, that's crazy. The way the manuscripts are divided too, Bill, suggests that it should be, you know, man from Cana, the way they're divided, so.
Absolutely, because the manuscripts that say Canaanite here say Cana in Mark. So, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andreas, his brother, they were with Christ from the very beginning. They saw Christ baptized by John the Baptist. They were followers of John the Baptist first, along with Nathaniel. Jacob and John, the sons of Zebedee, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthias, the tax collector, who Christ had just picked up, so to speak, in Matthew chapter 9. Now, this is interesting because Jacob, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and...
They're mentioned in a pair, and it sort of makes you feel like it's Jude.
That Thaddeus very well could be Jude.
They're associated with one another, right?
That they're associated with one another here, but they're also associated with one another in Mark chapter 3. Where it's James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and then they're associated with one another in Luke chapter 6, where it says, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, called the Zealot, and Judas, the brother of James.
Right.
So that leads, because that Thaddeus is missing in Luke chapter 6, it seems to me that Thaddeus is another name for Jude, the brother of James, who's also the brother of Christ. And it's revealed later in Scripture that these men, these two men, are the brethren of Christ, and in their own epistles. So if James, the elder, he's called the elder because, and James, the son of Zebedee, is called the lesser. Probably because James, the son of Alphaeus, is older in years. This James is the Apostle James of later Scripture and the author of the epistle from James, James the son of Alphaeus. And he's also, him and Jude are the brethren of Christ. We see them mentioned together in the company of Mary. Is this in Matthew chapter 13? Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary and his brethren, James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? Now, that Simon could very well be this Simon, the Canaanian. And maybe that's what that seems to be, why he's set between James and Jude in Luke.
So we could be seeing three brothers of Christ here?
Yes. Yes, I believe so.
Wow.
And here, James is called the son of Alphaeus, but he's the brother of Christ. And Mary has all these children, and she could not have had them with Joseph. She must have had them with a second husband that was named Alphaeus.
Wow.
Maybe Jude, having the same name as Judas, they're both Judah, maybe he didn't want to go by that name after the whole passion event. Maybe he didn't want to go by that name for a bit. It's like, just call me Thaddeus for a while, you know? So no one associated with him with the quip. I'm more so persuaded that Simon was Nathaniel. Because they're both
true, but Canaan. He's still Simon the Zealot and Simon the Canaan. And yes, right. That could very well be.
Well, in your commentary, you said it's pretty much a conclusion.
No, in my Matthew commentary, yeah, I say Matthew, some commentators believe Nathaniel to be Bartholomew instead, and that has no corroboration.
Just above that, though, it is therefore certain that these two men were one and the same. Simon and Nathaniel. Because it's mentioned five times, John.
Yeah, Nathaniel's there from the beginning, pretty much. And he's fishing with them in the Sea of Galilee at the end of John.
He disappears by that name. Until then.
But he could just be there in the peripheral vision too. Just not focusing on him. We don't really see Bartholomew, but we know he's there.
Sorry I'm late, but we had bad storms and flooding, and I've had a hard time, but I'm okay now, and I'm with y'all.
Hi, Gerald. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Gerald.
Gerald, I've been trying to call you.
Phone's been out.
That's what I figured.
Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, and Nathanael said to him, and blah, 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 blah. Well, there's no indication that Nathanael is a brother to Philip or Andrew or to Simon Peter. In John 21:2, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, which seems to be why I identify Nathanael as this Simon, but that does not rule out the possibility that Nathanael being this Simon is also one of the sons of Mary in Matthew 13.
He doesn't seem to recognize Christ, though, Nathanael, when he's introduced to him. And he even says, like, can anything good come out of Nazareth?
Right, that's true. That works against that association. You're right. That's good.
To me, it really feels like one or the other. Like he's either Nathanael or he's potentially a brother of Christ.
We or just never have neither. Enough information, though, to be able to say definitively.
Yeah, no, you don't. You don't.
It's difficult.
All we know about Bartholomew is that he's the son of a man named, what would that be, Maos or something? Bartholomew's? That's all we know about Bartholomew.
Well, right, just from his name, that's what it means, right?
Yeah, it's like all we know about him. We know a little more about some of the others, but those are just sparse details.
In the custom, when a wife lost their husband, was it not customary for a brother to take her as his wife? And if that is the case, could Alphaeus be a brother of Joseph?
Or next of kin, if he wasn't a brother, he may have been like an uncle or a first cousin or a nephew or something, right? Whoever the next of kin is to Joseph that's surviving and it's able to take a wife. Because evidently Joseph was a lot older than Mary.
Right, but someone that is related in the family somehow or another.
Yeah, it wasn't just some strange guy she met in the bar, that's for sure. It would be one of the next of kin of Joseph.
A nephew, you wouldn't, that's, there'd be an age gap there.
Actually, you know. Maybe not though, Joe, because back then, I mean, you know.
Not a Joseph as we suspect. I mean, the scripture doesn't say that explicitly, but he seems to be a lot older than Mary. So if he was 20 years older than Mary, which was typical back then for a man to take a bride 20 years younger, or even more than that, then a nephew would be her age.
You know, like there could be a gap of 25 years in between siblings, which is just still the case, but I mean, it's not as common. It's very uncommon these days, but you know, even 100, 200 years ago.
Look at the gaps between Abraham and his siblings, right? They were like 50 years. between him and his oldest brother. It was a long time. I don't remember exactly how long it was exactly, but I spoke about it in my Genesis commentary.
Like, you could definitely be old. Your nephew could be older than you, you know, like traditionally in the past. You know, and even like a woman could have a grandson who is older than her son or daughter.
Some of my kids have aunts and uncles that are only 3 and 4 years older than them.
If she had a son when she was 17 or 18, and then, I mean, back then there was no age of majority, of course. And then, you know, that guy's 20, and then he has a child, and then she has a baby at 40. You know what I mean?
Well, it happens all the time. It literally happens all the time, even in modern times, that there could be 15 to 20 years between two siblings. And by the time the mom is having the youngest child, the oldest sister is having her first or her second. It does happen. It's not as common anymore because people don't have so many kids anymore. Most people. Back in the day, families were big, especially farm families were big, 10, 12 kids.
Sure, even just like 250 years ago, I think Ben Franklin was the 19th child, and he was the youngest in his family.
Yeah. 19th child.
Wow. That's cool.
My grandmother told me that one of her grandfather's Grant had like 18 children. And my grandmother's grandfather, Charles Grant, was I got pictures of him from the 30s and 40s. He was a poor as dirt peasant farmer, tenant farmer in Massachusetts. But my grandmother told me he came from a family of 18 brothers and sisters.
Dang, that's a lot. That's where the old saying came from, keep them pregnant and barefooted where they behave themselves, right?
Yeah, right. 18 kids. That poor woman spent 5-10 years of her life pregnant, more than 10 years probably.
Yeah, when I was in school, we had two families. We had the Snyders, they had 12 kids, and the Crowleys, they had 18. And you look at all these big houses, these old houses, how big they are, and that's what it was for, all those kids they were having. Unbelievable.
Shall we continue?
Yes.
Joe's like,
come on. We haven't spoken about Judas Iscariot.
All right.
So let me just say that Iscariot doesn't make any sense in English or even in Greek. But it had to come from the words ish and kerioth in Hebrew. And it's not only Judas that's described as Iscariot, it's also his father. Where we see in John chapter 13 that John calls him Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. So that's not necessarily a surname. It's a place name that they're from is how people identified themselves in those days. They might have more than one given name, but Hebrews didn't have like surname family names, not throughout scripture. The Romans did, but not all of these Hebrews in Judea were Romanized or even Hellenized. So Iscariot has to be from the words ish and kerioth, which is man of kerioth, and kerioth in Judea was a town of ancient Judah that was on near the border of Judah and Edom. It was really a town of the Edomites in the time of Christ.
And later Christ says that he's a devil and that he's unclean, so you add all that up.
Yes.
Calls him a son of destruction too, because he's a vessel of destruction.
You know, was Jesus just being mean, or was Jesus slandering him? I don't think so. Jesus isn't going to slander anyone. He wasn't being mean. It was factual. He was a devil. Your dog wants to say something, Bill.
Yeah, you know, it's storming very bad here, and Otto's cage on the side of the house, he has a cage that's like 7 feet wide and about 18 feet long, I think. Maybe a little longer than that. Well, it's totally flooded out. It rained so hard here for about 3 hours until about 7:30. That his whole cage is flooded out. So I put him in a pen under the house when that happens. Plus, he has all kinds of anxiety about the lightning and the thunder. And I just put him in a pen under the house. But yeah, the cats, we have cats. We have a possum that we actually feed. And other animals are always around, and they always set the dogs off, right? If it wasn't storming tonight, then they'd all be out in the yard in their cages. Well, we have a big pen for the dachshunds in the back of the yard that's separate. Like a 10 by 10 pen with a doghouse. Melissa doesn't want to keep them out there in thunderstorms, and I can't say I blame her, because our yard gets split easy. So I'm sorry about the noise, y'all, but I can't help it.
Yeah, fair enough.
There they go.
Should we continue?
Yes.
Sure. Yep.
I reckon.
All right. These 12 Yahshua sent out, commanding to them, saying, "You shall not depart into the way of the heathens, and you shall not enter into a city of Samaritans, but rather you must go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And going you proclaim, saying that the kingdom of the heavens has neared. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. Freely you have received, freely you must give. Do not procure gold, nor silver, nor copper for your belts, nor a bag for the way, nor two cloaks, nor sandals, nor a staff. For the workman is worthy of his provisions. And into whatever city or town you should enter, scrutinize whether anyone in it is worthy, and there abide until when you would depart. But going into the house, you shall greet it. And indeed, if the house should be worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it should not be worthy, your peace must return to you. And whoever would not receive you, nor hear your words, going out of that house or city, shake off the dust from your feet. Truly I say to you, it shall be better for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. Behold, I send you off as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpents and pure as doves. But take heed on account of men, for they shall hand you over to councils, and they shall whip you in their assembly halls, and you shall be brought before governors and even kings because of me, for a testimony to them and to the nations. And when they should hand you over, you should not have care for how or what you should speak, for it shall be given to you at that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who are speaking, but the Spirit of your Father which is speaking in you. For brother shall hand over brother unto death, and father child, and children shall rise up against parents and shall slay them. And you shall be hated by all on account of my name, but he abiding to the end shall be saved. And when they should persecute you in this city, flee to another. For truly I say to you, by no means should you exhaust the cities of Israel until when the Son of Man should come. There is not a student above the teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for a student that he may be as his teacher, and a servant as his master. If they have called in the master of the house Beelzebul, how much more those of his house. I'll stop there.
These children that rise up against their parents, that happens all the time when, you know, they have mixed race children and they're like violent little apes and they kill their parents.
Yeah, but you even see it in Christian families when someone is following the law and trying to follow Christ and their parents or their siblings are worldly and they hate them for it.
Well, they especially hate it when you try and rebuke them for their sin while still loving them.
Yeah. And I think Christ is actually quoting something in Micah. I think in Micah it is. There's like a very similar statement there.
This verse here at 22, and you shall be hated by all on account of my name, but he abiding to the end shall be saved. That, I think, the saved there would be preserved in this life. It's not talking about if you believe something, you're going to heaven. If you don't know Jesus, you're going to hell. That's definitely temporal salvation there.
And it's sort of like enduring, because in Luke, in the Olivet Discourse, Christ says in your endurance, you will gain your lives, right? In your endurance, you will gain your lives. And that's, it's not your spirit, it's your life.
Yeah, your life in this world, not the next, because obviously all white men are going to be in the kingdom and have different rewards in the kingdom based on their works in this life. So every white man's in the kingdom, but different rewards, as we say.
It's like Christ telling us, when you're persecuted, hang on, sort of thing, right? Like,
hang on, exactly.
Keep going.
That's how I read it.
Yeah.
Yeah, be faithful to the end.
Ricky, they're touching an area that we discussed Sunday about all of Israel will be in heaven.
Praise God for that.
Hallelujah.
Racial salvation, it's in the Bible. It's the promise of the Bible that all the seed of Abraham would be justified by God in Isaiah 45.
People sometimes try to use verse 5 to say that the Samaritans are not Israel. And I think Christ here is clearly speaking on geographical terms. Also taking into mind what the apostles know. And I think Bill's trying to talk, but he's muted or something.
Yeah, I muted my mic so y'all didn't hear my dogs, and then I forgot to unmute it when I wanted to talk, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We have all night. I'm looking at my commentary from Matthew chapter 24. And he abiding to the end, he shall be saved. A very similar, but he who endures unto the end, he shall be preserved. Matthew 24:13.
And that's the Olivet Discourse, I think.
And this good message of the kingdom shall be proclaimed in the whole inhabited earth for testimony to all the nations, and then shall the end come. So this is connected to the eschatology, to that return of Christ, end time, in the Olivet Discourse, right? In Matthew chapter 24, Luke chapter 21, and you shall be hated by all on account of my name, yet a hair from your head shall by no means be lost. In your endurance must you gain your lives. He's not talking to people in general. He's talking to his apostles and how the things that they have to face in order to spread the gospel, the word of his message, right? He's talking to them. That this doesn't apply to everybody in general. It applies to those people to whom he gave this burden of spreading this good message of the kingdom. You can't deny Christ. Once you're given this task, you can't deny Christ. If you deny him, he'll deny you before your Father who is in heaven, right? So when you meet that resistance from your own family, even, you can't deny him, and you have to stand steadfast in his word. And in that way, in your endurance, you gain your lives, as it says in Luke 21:19.
So, Bill, he was talking to his apostles back then, but he's talking to us now, right?
Yeah, you know, it could very well be read that way because it's applicable in the time of the end when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies, right? And there's great tribulation happening. So we in great tribulation have to stand our course, have to stand steadfast.
Well, this is the only study that gets you prosecuted.
Yep.
I'm sorry?
I said this is the only study that would get you prosecuted. These other religions wouldn't.
Absolutely not. Nobody's going to prosecute a Roman Catholic or a Greek Orthodox or any other profession of Christianity. They might laugh at them. The world might laugh at them.
Hell no, they'll put them on the payroll.
Yeah. That too.
You know, something I just thought of, and I have to say it, is that Paul abided to the end, but his life was not preserved. His life was taken short. So in knowing that, how would we think about this verse then?
You'll find out to when you get where you're going. I don't think Paul's life was really taken short. He lived a good long life. He was probably at least 60 years old. For that time, he wasn't doing bad.
I would say that death is not a bad thing. It's a glorious thing. He said to weep when they enter, rejoice when they leave.
He's entering into life. And yeah, I think there's, 30 years between the stoning of Stephen and Paul's execution? Something right. Like that? Right, that's a long time.
Yeah, but it can't be talking about heavenly salvation because all the white race is saved. That's proven elsewhere. So it has to be talking about temporal salvation, yet Paul and some of the other apostles did die in the faith. Well, and I'm not saying we shouldn't expect that, but...
This isn't so much of a promise as it is a challenge.
I mean, I'm thinking of that verse in the Wisdom of Solomon where it says, the righteous man, his life is taken.
This is a challenge, Joe. It's not really a promise. It's a challenge. If you read it as a challenge, it all makes sense.
So is it like a challenge no one can actually stand up to because we all sin and fall short? Is that what you're saying, Bill?
Well, it's a challenge to stay steadfast in the Word of God until the end. Yeah, that's a huge challenge. The Apostle John did it. He was like...
Probably 90.
Probably close to 90 years old, right?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, but I think what you mean by that is that your life could be cut short compared to the length of time it would have been if you had stayed steadfast. You know what I mean? Because as a challenge, he's saying if you stay steadfast, then you'll basically live as long as you were supposed to.
Yeah, your life might be cut short. Yeah, your life might be cut short, but you'll have a greater life at the other side. And you'll have a greater reward at the other side if you stand steadfast. So he who will lose his wife shall find it. It's not that that all Israel isn't going to be saved. It's when you meet these challenges that you have greater rewards if you stand steadfast.
And so a martyr for the word of the Father would be of a highest reward.
I don't know if we can say what is or what isn't the highest reward.
Yeah,
because God judges every man differently based on what he knows and what he's gone through and so many things we can't take into account.
the cross reference would be to Paul, where he says he talks about a better salvation then.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Hebrews, yeah. Yeah. The better resurrection, those women who, yeah.
And his apostles had a greater promise in that the example when they were told that they would be sitting on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So that's what that's the goal that they should have been expected to seek, right?
Even Christ sort of spoke as if they earned that reward even during his own ministry, because I think in Luke he says, you are those who have remained with me in my trials. Therefore, I delegate you a kingdom as my Father has delegated me a kingdom. And he speaks more so concerning
that. But at the same time, they really can't earn that reward. They were chosen by him.
Well, of course. Reward. Yeah, of course. They didn't really earn it. I know. Maybe a poor choice of words.
That they stayed. From a male perspective, from a man's perspective, it seems like they earned it. But no, from his perspective, he chose them for that purpose. And he chose for them to be successful in that purpose even before they were born.
Giving them repentance, giving them conformity, giving them obedience.
Yeah. Right. That all comes from him.
Isn't it true, Bill, that all the apostles were martyred except for John?
Well, the truth is that the Catholic Church is full of shit with their medieval stories. That's the truth.
Thank you.
And the truth is that we just don't know what happened to most of the apostles. There are no records. The earliest records are from like the 4th century AD. So we don't have any solid evidence of the fates of hardly any of the apostles.
Okay, I'm not sure where I got that from. I heard it somewhere, and that's what I thought.
No. I don't blame you for that. No, that's the general sentiment. That's what Christians in general believe. And what I'm saying is that the common belief isn't necessarily correct, because the medieval church made up a lot of stories or pulled them out of thin air, and later church fathers made up a lot of stories that we don't have verification of. And I'm not going to necessarily accept a story from the 4th century AD if that writer, like Eusebius of Caesarea, is not telling us where he got it from, what his sources were, and we don't see it documented anywhere. And the medieval church had a lot of stories about the 12 apostles that actually conflict with our scriptures.
Yep.
So I can't accept them.
You know, I think there's even one story of an apostle going to Japan that they tell, which is just stupid, because I mean, I don't even want to get into it.
Yeah, I know. I think they say Philip went to India, or maybe Thomas.
Yeah, I think it's Thomas.
The only apostles whose fate I can know are John, at least for 90 years of his life, right? And Paul of Tarsus, who was killed in Rome in the time of Nero, probably in 62 AD, maybe 63. And James, the brother of Christ.
And James, the brother of John too, Bill.
Yeah, James, the brother of John, was killed in Acts chapter 12, but I'm speaking about later than the end of the New Testament, right?
But
he was killed in Acts chapter 12, yes. James, the brother of Christ, was actually, it's recorded in Flavius Josephus in Antiquities Book 20, that he was stoned to death by the Sadducees right around the same time that Paul was in Rome, like 62 AD. And Josephus actually pinpoints it down to a time when the proconsul, I think it was Porcius Festus, which actually means happy pig in Latin, I swear.
Porcius Festus. Wow. Was that his actually his name, Bill? Was that actually his name? Wow.
Porcius Festus. Happy freaking happy pig.
Imagine going by happy pig.
It's like festive pig. Yeah, I ain't lying.
All right. Wow. Truth is stranger than
you got me laughing. I can't finish. I'm sorry. Well, when Porcius Festus actually died suddenly. I guess they had the vax back then too. Or the Jews poisoned them, one or the other. Well, he died, and Rome was sending his replacement, and I think his replacement's name was Lucius Albinus or something like that. And it took him like some time, like a month or two, to get to Judea to take over the Roman government. So basically, the Sadducees and the Pharisees had their run of the place because there was no Roman governor, and they stoned James during that time. And they were reprimanded after Albinus took over, but he didn't really do anything to them.
Didn't you see this right, that they chased James off a cliff and he fell off the cliff, and then they thought he was dead, and then they found out he wasn't dead, and then they stoned him. I think that's what he wrote.
Antiquities.
Maybe I'm thinking of some other story or something.
Antiquities 20, and this is paragraph 200. I'll read from 198. Now the report goes that this oldest Ananus, and he was from the family of that he was the Ananus of the time of Christ, that he proved the most fortunate man, for he had five sons who had all performed the office of a high priest to God. Ananus was the high priest before a few priests before Caiaphas, and he was only the high priest himself for about 10 years, and Caiaphas was the high priest for like 20 something years. So you always see Ananus and Caiaphas together in the gospel accounts. They're always together, and this is that Ananus, right? And he was an old man by then. So he had five sons that were high priest, and who had himself joined that dignity a long time formerly. I think that was from about 5 or 6 AD to about 15 or 16 AD, if my memory serves me right, but it often don't. So, but this younger Ananus, meaning a son of his, who, as we have told you already, took the high priesthood, was a bold man in his temper and was very insolent. He was also of the sect of the Sadducees. All the families of Ananus and Caiaphas were Sadducees, who are very rigid in judging offenders, above all the rest of the Judeans, as we have already observed. When, therefore, Ananus was of this disposition, he thought that he now had a proper opportunity to exercise his authority. Festus was now dead, and Albinus was but upon the road. So he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges, which were all Judeans, and all either Sadducees or Pharisees, and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, or some of his companions. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. And they were stoned. There was nothing about a cliff or anything
that. Where did I read that, man? I don't know. I remember reading it years ago, so I was likely reading some bullshit story somewhere.
I heard the same story, man.
You did? You did? Okay.
I can't remember where I heard it before, but it's the same exact thing. And he was like clubbed beforehand after he fell off the cliff or something.
Where the hell did I get this from?
I don't know if there's any I don't remember anything more to it than that.
Maybe it's one of those gay Catholic stories, you know? It might be one of those gay Catholic myths.
The early medieval Catholics made up all kinds of bullshit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think like every apostle has 10 conflicting martyrdom stories. Like one guy will say he was thrown into a sea with an anchor attached to him, and then somebody else will write he was whipped or scourged, and another will say he was fed to lions. And who's right? I'd say none of the above.
Well, that Ananias, he actually became a sycophant and was rewarded and became a friend of Albinus's after he came and Albinus came and took office.
Well, before we move on, I've got another idea on what the is a verse 22 says, where it says, but he abiding to the end shall be saved, right? I think that could be in the context of verse 15, where it says, truly I say to you, it shall be better for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. So if you're faithful to Christ, you won't get caught up in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. You will be preserved to the end, like Lot. You'll be delivered from the city, right? So that doesn't, it's in that context that you will escape the judgment of God. He who is faithful to the end, he shall be saved.
And that's a good observation, and that is the context here. But that also correlates perfectly with what I said about Matthew chapter 24 and Luke chapter 21, where the same saying is found.
We're agreeing then. That's good.
Right, but I don't see it as a promise. I see it as a challenge that you have to be steadfast and you have to accept the responsibility that you've been given to spread this gospel message. And if you don't, and then you're like the person who was given a lamp and hid it under a couch, well, you're gonna burn your damn couch down first. So it's gonna be worse for you than just putting a lamp right out front and center.
Yeah.
or the servant that hid his mina, his gold piece in a hole in the ground in the backyard because he didn't want to lose it.
In the very next verse, Bill talks about cities, and when they should persecute you in this city, flee to another. For truly I say to you, by no means should you exhaust the cities of Israel until when the Son of Man should come. And the thing is, you know, so that's in the context of what I was saying. But the other thing is, until the Son of Man should come, we should have cities to flee to. I mean, they're trying to trap us in these smart cities, hey? And here, Christ is giving the promise that we should always have a city to flee to until he comes back.
Yeah, so that's interesting to me. You hop into your Tesla and you drive it to the next smart city.
If push comes to shove, we can all move to Reykjavik in Iceland.
Man, sure, I mean, that's for our day too. This prophecy is definitely for our day, because until the Son of Man should come, he's talking to us.
What would a city be though? Because like in biblical terms, a city would be what, 10,000 people?
Not even.
Yeah.
How would you define it?
I wouldn't say a city would be 10,000 people. Some cities were very large. Jerusalem and Rome were both upwards of 1 million people, easily.
Oh, right, but what would be considered a city could still be something like 5,000 people, right?
Would that still be, yeah, that's what I mean. Would that still be a city?
Even today, it's the same way.
That is more developed. That's more developed than my local area, hey. 1 million people, that's massive.
Yeah, even today, David, I mean, there are cities in Florida that are cities that only have like 5,000 people in them.
Yeah, and also in Canada. And it usually depends on if they're the largest metropolitan area in a large area that's very rural. And then, you know, how it is here, like, that's where the county courthouse will be and the only high school and so forth. And
maybe this is how I'll get more south every year, you know, it's going from one city to the next and I'll end up in Florida or something.
Like, I've been to so many cities here, well, small towns here, and it'll say, you know, I've looked it up on Wikipedia and the population will be around 5,000, which is, for example, like the Funiac Springs. But then you get there and there's definitely more than 5,000 people there at any given time in the daytime, because all the smaller areas, rural communities around them, that's where they go to work and so forth. And it seems like a town that's at least triple that size. Maybe more. I don't know.
You know what else is, today all the non-whites hang around the cities, right? And in back in those days, it was all the Edomites hanging around in the main city of Jerusalem, and all the white folk, I guess, were out in the rural areas outside the city, you know?
Yeah.
This is a little delayed, but apparently it was Clement, I think, that said that James was clubbed and stoned afterward.
Oh, you found out.
Well,
I don't know too much. I just thought Noble had a dream.
Josephus said he wasn't clubbed, but Josephus didn't draw a really graphic picture, and he had no need to do that. I mean, I don't necessarily believe the 300-year-later accounts.
Yeah, same.
I was just sharing where...
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good that you found that.
At least I know I didn't imagine it. Someone else did.
That's what I thought, Noble. Just kidding.
Yeah, we don't actually know.
I'm not actually that mean. Am I?
Nah, you're not.
Are we going to keep reading, Bill, or have we got more to say about this? Seven. There's a bit about Beelzebul here.
Doesn't that mean Lord of Dun?
Lord of Dun or Lord of the Flies, whether you want to say it's Beelzebul or Beelzebub.
So basically like a Pidgeot or something.
Well, flies gather on dung, right? That's what you mentioned in your... commentary.
Yes.
So it was probably like almost like an idiomatic expression for what you said, like Lord of Dung or Lord of Shit.
How dare they call Christ that?
Yeah, I know. And they still say that in their Talmud. We all know what it says in that part of the Talmud. I'm not going to. But
yeah,
they still do.
A day of vengeance.
Yeah, well, they'll all die and they'll be splattered across his raiment.
Then we'll see.
Matthew 10:25. Well, we're probably going to wind this out with this chapter thing. We got more things to speak about. I'm a little... All right, Beelzebul. It's Beelzebul in the NA-27 in Matthew 10:25. But of course, there's notes. It's Beelzebul in the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus, which doesn't make any sense. But it's not Beelzebub in any major manuscripts in this passage, in this verse. It's Beelzebul in the Washingtonensis, the Beze, the Ephraim Isiri, and the majority text. Even though the King James Version defied the majority text in Matthew 10:25 and translated it Beelzebub, which is from the Latin Vulgate and the Latin manuscripts in the New Testament and the Syriac, but no Greek manuscripts. It varies from place to place, though. It really does. Matthew chapter 12, verse 4. No, verse 24. I'm sorry. Turn the page. I don't think I should go through all of them. I don't think it's worth it to go through all of them.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah, I don't think so, bro.
But in Matthew 12, 24, it's Beelzebul in all the Greek manuscripts and Beelzebub in some minor manuscripts. From Latin and Syriac, same thing. And the other spot I want to check was Matthew 12, 27. I'll contain it to Matthew. Beelzebul. Same thing. Beelzebul. And even the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus in Matthew 12, 27. And in Matthew 12, 24, have Beelzebul, not Beelzebul. So, am I saying that right? No, they have Beelzebul there also. I'm sorry. I said it wrong. I read it wrong. They have Beelzebul there as well. So they have Beelzebul, but Beelzebul has to be wrong. It's got to be an early copyist mistake, because Beelzebul and Beelzebub have a Hebrew meaning. If you look those words up, it's Baal-Zebul and Baal-Zebub. It's Baal, which means Lord or Master. It's the idol of the ancient Canaanites. So it's Baal-Zebub. It has an etymology in Hebrew. That has to be... The proper reading has to be Baal-Zebul, or in Matthew at least. And I'm sure some of the other manuscripts, it might be Baal-Zebub is the prominent reading of those manuscripts.
So
I'm going to go check them all tonight. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll check the others before we do Matthew chapter 12, before we get that far and talk about it a little more.
Were they calling Christ this because they were trying to like insult him and offend him, or were they referring to an idol called Beelzebub? Was there an idol with that name?
You know, I don't know if there was an idol of that name, but I wouldn't doubt it.
Okay.
I'll explain why I wouldn't doubt it. Because of the way the Egyptians worshipped the dung beetle.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
The scarabs and the Hebrews have them too. And that may or may not be Egyptian influence on their seals, on many seals that were found from ancient Israel, seals of ancient kings and priests, they have a dung beetle. And the dung beetle did come to be worshipped in Egypt because of its role in ensuring the fertility of the soil. They made that connection. They knew that back then, that the dung in the soil, that the beetles helped spread it and sow it into the soil, and that made the soil more fertile. They knew that. So they worshiped the beetle instead of the God that created it.
Yeah, it's sickening. Just like how Joe said, it's sickening that they would call him this.
Yeah, then they have a god for every little element of creation rather than having the god in their mind.
Yeah.
They're not really calling Christ Beelzebul, but they certainly are associating him with the idol. So they're basically, you are what you associate with. You are who you associate with. So they're basically, calling him a lord of the shed, right? Or a lord of the flies, or the flies on the dung, whatever. So they're associating him with that.
Yeah, actually, you didn't really write about it in the commentary, but it was in the podcast for Matthew 10.
Okay,
some things just stick in your brain. I actually remember exactly where I was when I heard that. It was like 6 years ago. Anyway.
Oh, all right.
And then Trump's the modern day.
So there I was.
Well, he must have spent considerable time, I believe, with these men up to this point. I mean, maybe 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever. But because he has, I send you off as sheep in the midst of wolves, therefore be ye wise as serpents and as pure as doves. It's the instructions, you don't give instructions like that. I mean, I know he's God and he knows everybody, right? But it doesn't seem like you would give instructions, a teacher would give instructions like that to students that he hardly knows, right?
It's not orientation.
Right. Yeah, right. This is the graduation speech. It's not an orientation speech, right?
I always got the impression that Matthew's gospel never tries to be chronological. It's really ordered by theme. Like Matthew, he groups the parables together by theme. He's grouping every part of his gospel together by theme. I think it was Luke who really tried to be chronological. And John too, to an extent, with his counting of the Passovers. But I never really see that in Matthew. I think Matthew, I don't think he was trying to make it chronological.
That is very well the case, because there are one or two anachronisms in Matthew. I believe I pointed one of them out in relation to the anointing of Christ and whether it happened before or after he went through the gate on the foal of an ass, right? On the donkey. I think it's John that has it after, and Matthew has it before, or something like
right.
that.
I don't know the exact detail. I can't remember. I don't know. The great thing about these little discrepancies is it really shows us that the Gospels were not just mere copies of one another.
Right, absolutely.
Which is what a lot of fools say that. They always say, like, oh, this Q document. And like, oh, this all this bullshit they talk about. And it's like, if they were copies, why are they making these mistakes if they're just looking to their left and copying it?
And they do the same thing with Genesis, right? With the books of Moses, all the books of Moses. They have an E author and a Q historian author and a priestly author. And one of them like doctored up the other's manuscripts or whatever. And it's just all bullshit.
They do that with Genesis because Genesis 1 has Elohim and El, and then Yahweh doesn't appear at a certain point, and they think that Yahweh was a later scribe and all this shit.
Right. And it's all bullshit.
Yeah, they're fools.
It may not be Matthew. It might be Luke. Luke and John might be the conflict in that aspect.
Best bet is to side with John because he was there.
Right. I agree. With Luke, with John, it's in John chapter 12. And she does that just before he makes his triumphant entry through the gate of Jerusalem for what they call Palm Sunday today, right? The people spread palms in a way. I think in Luke it happened after. If it's not Luke, it must be Matthew. Luke 7 is too early for that. Yeah, Luke 7. Luke 7 happened before, but it could have happened twice. One of the first seeming conflicts in the chronology that I remember.
Right, yeah. That's likely a good resolution for most of them, that it just happened twice or happened three times or whatever. Especially for statements and parables, he can place those anywhere. He likely repeated his parables all the time.
I'd have to go back to my John commentary and see what I wrote about it, but it's not important to do right now.
No, it's not.
I don't know if there's anything else here we have. He who receives you receives me. He receiving me receives he who sent me. That's why we have to be really careful as Christians not to reject our fellow Christians.
Yeah.
Because if we reject somebody with good intentions that's trying to live their lives in a godly manner, we're basically rejecting Christ.
Yeah,
unless they're flat earth trolls, then they got to go. I'm sorry.
So, verse 5 here, you should not depart into the way of the heathens, and you should not enter into a city of Samaritans, but rather you must go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That's pretty interesting. The Samaritans were a mixed bag. They were not all Israelites. It was like a mixed multitude of people. The woman at the well in John 4 is an Israelite. She is. But as John writes in the second chapter of his gospel, Christ could tell what was in a man. So Christ wouldn't have an issue with telling which Samaritan is an Israelite and which one isn't. But I think even more than that, he must be speaking on geographical terms here. And,
Well, let me say this, that there's no race really called Samaritans. All the references to Samaritans can only be geographical.
Yeah.
Because Samaria was a mixed race state, just like Judea was at this time.
That's why
so
I
all
said
those references are only geographic.
Yeah.
There's no tribe of Samaritans. I'm glad you brought this back up because I meant to speak about it earlier and we got distracted. That the way the apostles would have understood this is not the way it would have been understood in the overall scheme of the prophecies and promises of God that we would understand it today. That these lost sheep of the house of Israel, they would have seen them as the Israelites in Judea or Samaria or wherever they were, who were circumcised and keeping the law. Now, that woman at the well, she was a Samaritan, but she was keeping the law, and her fathers had worshipped in a temple because they built their own temple in that mountain that she referred to. And it's well detailed in the Antiquities of Josephus. The Samaritans built their own temple because the Judeans wouldn't allow them into Jerusalem to worship there. And that's because the Judeans, who still had their genealogies at that time, I'm talking about the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC, the Judeans still had their genealogies and they were maintaining their own exclusivity as they would be expected to. So they didn't trust any Samaritans. The Samaritans didn't have their genealogies. Even those that were Israelites no longer had their genealogies. They couldn't prove it. But the woman professed to be an Israelite, and Christ, knowing what was in a man, he agreed with her. He never rebuked her for that or denied her that. He obviously agreed with her because she made that statement and he kept talking to her. So she couldn't have been a liar. So there were a lot of Samaritans that were Israelites that knew they were Israelites, but they couldn't prove it to the Judeans to gain access to worship in Jerusalem. So they actually built their own temple in a mountain in Samaria. I don't know if I could find the, I might be able to.
No, it's all good, Bill. You've cited it in your John commentary.
And the Samaritans had their own copy of the law, right? Of Moses?
Yeah, I mean, the Samaritan Pentateuch, if that's indeed original, but we don't really know that that's original to these ancient Samaritans from the time of Nehemiah and Ezra.
And those monkeys, they still call themselves Samaritans.
So essentially these Samaritans during the time of Christ were just working on complete faith.
Yes. So, when Christ gave these instructions to his apostles, they would have done with it how they would have understood to do with it. Yeah, you know what? And they would have only gone to the circumcised Israelites. That's all they would have gone to, because that's how they would have understood it. That certainly Peter demonstrates that in Acts chapter 10.
Right, and also even after that, when he goes and he sees Paul in Antioch.
Yes, the Samaritan temple was in Mount Gerizim, the highest of all the mountains that are in Samaria. I just couldn't remember that name.
If they were still under the law and circumcised, and that's how the apostles understood it, then why are they lost sheep?
Well, how would the apostles have understood that? That they had no real shepherds. The Pharisees and Sadducees weren't their shepherds.
It's like in Isaiah 53, we are all sheep, we have all gone astray.
Yeah, but I always think of the dispersion when I think of the lost sheep. Like,
yeah. No, me too.
Well, I equate the Samaritan woman to what we read in Isaiah chapter 56. About those who were put off in captivity, meaning they were no longer in a kingdom that was operating under the laws of Yahweh. And even though she wasn't off in the Assyrian captivity, she was still in a sort of captivity.
Yeah.
And keeping the Sabbaths or striving to keep the Sabbaths and the laws, she's just like the eunuch in a dry tree in Isaiah 56.
So Christ wanted them to go to circumcised, explicit,
what I'm saying is that that's how the apostles would have understood that, Joe.
But was that to fulfill prophecy or something like that? Like, they have to go to those people
first? I will save
the
tents of Judah first.
Yeah.
I believe it works with that prophecy. I will save the tents of Judah first. Zechariah chapter... whatever, 12, 14, I forget.
Yeah, I couldn't remember it either.
Zechariah chapter 12, verse 7. At least I kind of had it right.
And that really... Yeah. Sorry, Joe. I don't mean to step on your toes.
All these miracles are being fulfilled in Jerusalem, and all these prophecies are being fulfilled in Jerusalem. And then it's only later that they start doing miracles outside of Jerusalem and bringing in like the sheep from other pens and that. So it does seem that it is in reference to that prophecy about Judah being saved first.
And Christ, heals Romans. He heals their servants, right? And their Judahites. So it's so interesting, right? That doesn't break it. When he helps the centurion servant.
Even I think I associated this with that prophecy in my commentary. Even when Paul wanted to go to the cities of the Greeks in Asia Minor, Christ told him no, to go to Illyria. He sent him to Illyria.
Oh, Illyria.
He sent him into Macedonia and Illyria. And I sincerely believe that many of the Macedonians and all of the Illyrians were also descended from the Trojans, from the Dardans of Troy.
And you were saying that you know how Christ meets that Samaritan woman and then he goes into her village? They were Judahites too, even though they were being called Samaritans.
Well, you know, maybe also they're in the tent of Judah. They're under the tent of Judah. They're in the land of Judah because I'm sure Christ healed Benjamites, right? I mean, the apostles were Benjamites, a lot of them. So maybe it's more so tent of Judah as in like the lands of Judah where Judah spreads its tent.
You know, I think that the Samaritan woman, that whether she was of Ephraim or Manasseh or Judah is immaterial in her context, because first he didn't really go to her. He only wanted water. And that's the way, I mean, I know he's God and he knew everything that was going to happen in advance. But the way it's presented to men, he only wanted water and he spoke to her because she was a pious woman that believed in him and ostensibly an Israelite also, and he couldn't refuse her. On what grounds could he possibly have refused her? So she was, to me, she fits the mold of Isaiah chapter 56, I think it is, the eunuch in a dry tree. It might be 53, I don't even know. So she fits that mold perfectly. Isaiah 56. I was right the first time.
I love those moments in the Gospels where Christ says, I am he who is speaking to you. And people are just like, what? You know, like, I love those moments. I love that. That's just, wow. Imagine how
he
would feel.
Why would he say that? Why would he ever say that except to associate himself with Isaiah?
To prove the Trinity, Bill.
Yeah, right.
To disprove it.
Exactly. It disproves the Trinity.
Oh, so you're trying to wrap it up?
I'm sorry. Yeah, we've gone long enough. This is good.
Okay. No, I was saying, should we try to wrap it up, like try to finish it off? But I guess we can end. It's been a while.
Well, I think we should do chapter by chapter. I think we should read it all.
Are we all busy? Is Otto okay?
I didn't realize that we didn't finish this chapter. I'm sorry.
No, we got a little more here. It's really dense. It's a dense chapter. It's a lot of time.
Well, whatever you want to do then.
Go on.
Yeah, okay. I'm at verse 26. Therefore, you should not... Yeah, yeah. Okay. Therefore, you should not fear them, for nothing is hidden which shall not be revealed, and secret which shall not be made known. That which I say to you in the darkness, you speak in the light, and that which you hear in the ear, proclaim upon the houses. And do not fear from those killing the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear he who is able to slay soul and body in Gehenna. Are not two sparrows sold for an Assyrian? And one of these does not fall upon the earth without consent of your father. But of you, even the hairs of the head are all counted. Therefore, do not fear. You are worthy more than many sparrows. Therefore, each who shall agree with me before men, I shall also agree with him before my Father who is in the heavens. But he who should deny me before men, I shall also deny him before my Father who is in the heavens. You should not suppose that I have come to put peace upon the earth. I have not come to put peace, but a sword. For I have come to divide a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a bride against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies are those of his house. He loving father or mother above me is not worthy of me, and he loving son or daughter above me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow behind me is not worthy of me. He seeking his life shall lose it, and he losing his life because of me shall find it. He receiving you receives me, and he receiving me receives he who has sent me. He receiving a prophet in the name of a prophet gains reward of the prophet, and he receiving a righteous man in the name of a righteous man gains reward of the righteous man. And he who would give one of these little ones a single cup of cold water to drink in the name of a student, truly I say to you, by no means should he lose his reward.
So we don't really have to do much for our brethren, but we have to do something for them, right?
And it really shows you even the smallest actions of kindness and love that gets you a reward in the kingdom.
Yes.
Your God sees that. Your God sees you doing that. He's proud of you.
Now, cold water was, it was probably more dear at that time in Judea than Coca-Cola is today.
Here. I guess so. But still, it's a small act of kindness.
Or a cold beer. Cold water was valuable, right? Cold water was valuable. It was just brought up from the well to be cold water.
Okay.
No refrigerators, Bill?
Yeah, right. It wasn't like walking into a gas station and getting yourself a $2 bottle of water that's only worth 15 cents. No.
Yeah, but that's from the French Alps, Bill. That's quality elite water.
It's from the toilets in New York City, I think. Somebody friends. It's all Jews gaslighting us. The French Alps water probably comes from a tap in New Orleans.
I'm sure.
Nothing is hidden which shall not be revealed, and secret which shall not be made known. That which I say to you in the darkness, you speak in the light. So he's not talking about all the actions and deeds and secrets of men. He's talking about the word of God, that it's not hidden and it shall be made known. That's why Paul said there are no more mysteries.
Exactly right.
We have them all in Christ.
Catholics try to teach that their saints have been receiving like divine revelations over time, and that the church is always evolving and receiving new information. They said that about purgatory, that they say that purgatory was not always evident in the Bible, but the church has received it over time. And these are not things they receive from Christ. So it's not it's not a secret being revealed.
But it's that's like just their gaslighting technique to keep you in their reality, in what they want you to believe reality is.
Exactly.
It's like they've had a revelation that trannies can now come into the church. Oh, that's a revelation.
Yeah, they call it
from
that.
The Pope.
they have a revelation that the Pope should get on his knees and kiss nigger feet. No Pope ever did that before.
Some of the popes were actually pretty hardcore. Like the one who said something about, we're going to fight the beast. It's not man versus man, it's man versus beast. I remember them in one of them saying something like that when they fought the Arabs.
Yes, that they really did believe the Arabs were beasts. And rightfully so. But this medieval Spain, churches in medieval Spain, I've seen Roman Catholic churches in Spain with these huge, beautiful stained glass windows that portray the horses of Spanish knights stepping on niggerheads.
Nice.
That are clearly niggerheads. So that's what they thought of them. They put it on their churches.
Was that from the Reconquista?
Yes.
Yeah.
And this next part about who can slay the soul and body in Guyana. Well, if you're a sinner, God can put you in hell in the trials of this life and destroy you. It's like what Paul said, where you give up the sinner to the Satan, and once the body's destroyed, the spirit will be saved by God. So that's an earthly thing. That's, you've lost your temporal salvation from God because you're a grievous sinner, and now he's given you up to the enemy, and the enemy's going to destroy your body. So you're going to die in hell because you're a poofter, or because you're a race mixer, or something like that. You can expect to die in a sewer because of what you're doing, you know?
Well, a lot of our challenges are overcoming these mistranslations and these poor understandings of words, because the King James Version and all the other versions, they'll take Hades and translate it as hell, and they'll take Gehenna and translate it as hell. But it's really two completely different things.
And then they'll say the lake of fire is hell. So when Hades is thrown in the lake of fire, hell is being thrown into hell. And that makes sense.
It's Inception. Hellception.
Yeah, well, for the Catholics, it probably means that no one, you know, we can all hold hands and sing under a rainbow, and no one has to be mean to anyone anymore.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Hell's now in hell. We just sent hell to hell. We can all just be friends now.
No one has to go to hell anymore. You know, it doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
That's what they want. They want it to be just do whatever you want, and God will love you anyways. And that's the law of Satan. Isn't that the satanic law that they can't, you know, do what thou wilt?
Yep. I don't know if that's really a satanic law. That's what's that clown's name? That Aleister Crowley. Yeah, that's it. I don't know if anybody said it before him.
That fat piece of and he thought he was
happened to be an English intelligence officer also. So,
oh, that's right.
He was a tool. He was a tool.
So the soul here is your spirit, even though it's the Greek word. It's likely psuche or something, and it's here it's talking about the spirit, because I always felt like there was a distinction between psuche and Bill, you know, what's the word for spirit?
I purposely left it untranslated, but I wouldn't translate it as spirit. I should have probably translated it as life.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because it doesn't mean spirit, psuche.
Zoe is life, pneumos is spirit.
Psyche
is soul.
But either psuche or pneumos could just refer to a breath of wind in different contexts.
Right, yeah.
I always read it as both, because then you get a little, you know, it's interesting where it says like the wind blows where it will, you know, and then you're like the spirit blows where it will.
Yes. I would never translate pneumos as soul. I would only translate psuche as soul. But to me, the psuche represents your life, the animating force of your body, which is your spirit. But when your spirit's separated from your body, it doesn't animate your body anymore, but it still exists. So we're getting into like metaphysics here, right? Like theological metaphysics.
Right, yeah. But a lot of people, they assume it's the same thing when they hear soul. They just think of like your spirit, and it's not the same thing.
Right.
And all these churches today assume Christ has come to bring peace. He hasn't come to bring peace.
Nope.
I think they know better, but they just like the propaganda. They just push the propaganda.
Profitable, because then they can be part of Babylon.
Yes. And be at peace with it. And be at peace with trannies and faggots and all kinds of garbage.
Peace, but there is no peace.
Well, I see this, like, I've come to divide daughter against mother. I always think of that that woman who killed her daughter because she was a race mixer, both her daughters, and then she got the police to kill her. You remember that story? She was divided against her daughter because her daughter was about to marry a spick.
Right.
That's Shirley, a hard life.
Yeah, it is. But that's, I mean, what divides families is race mixing in the family. That divides a family.
Now, there are other things that can divide families, but that's the most divisive today.
And a man's enemies are those of his own house. You know, how do you know your enemies are in your house? They're in your base.
They're arguing over football teams.
And that's why we have to love Christ before we love father or mother, is because Christ can preserve a house pure. Whereas if you love your mother or father or worldly things, you're going to agree with their sins when they divide a household. You know, your dad separates from your wife, from your mother, and goes to Thailand, and you're like, oh, I don't want to divide from my father. He's my father, you know. But what he's doing, you know, you need to put Christ first. You need to be friends with Christ first. If your father goes to Thailand after divorcing your mother, he's dead to you. That's it. And all the little offspring he has over there, they're not your brothers and sisters. That sort of thing. So that's why we have to, you know, put Christ above mother and father, above, you know, brother and sister.
Yeah, it really disturbs me when I see a white man talk about his nieces, nephews, or even half brothers or half sisters that are really squat monsters or niggers, and calls them my brother and my sister. They're not. They're a zoo animal can't be your brother or your sister.
And it's a shame because they're taking away the inheritance from those who deserve it.
Yeah, devouring your house.
Right, but even if you disagree, even when they disagree with what their parents did, they still call their shitlets brother and sister. And just using those terms, they're subconsciously agreeing with what their parents did. They're accepting it. If I had a nigger brother, I'd the last thing I'd want to do is call him brother. It'd be, get out of here, you little shitlet. Beat it. You can't call anything but brother.
Instead of Lil Fink, which is what you call your brother, he'd be Little Shit Fink.
Little Shitlet. I wouldn't even call him Fink.
Sorry. Hey,
my poor brother went through life being called Little Fink his whole life.
Lil.
So in 41, I just want to mention, it can be kind of hard to interpret, or it seemed like that to me anyhow. But in your commentary, it's nice how you bring up 2 Kings chapter 4, the woman who made a place of rest for Elisha, and not really knowing if he was a prophet. And then she was rewarded, her child almost died. She was rewarded because she continued to abide in the faith. And so,
yes.
Basically an example for us and what we should do.
Right.
So Bill, that'd be practically denying Christ, accepting the little bastard child as your brother or kin people. That would be denying Christ.
Right. But so many people in the world just can't, that they accept the world and not the gospel. Even if they would agree with the gospel, they're so conditioned to the ways of the world that they would call it brother just because it's a legal brother, right? Just because under the legalisms of today's world, it's your brother. But that don't mean you have to abide by the legalisms of today's world. Doing so, you're departing from the gospel and loving the world.
Going right back to what Joe said, yeah. Put the father first.
So you can't, we can't accept the terms of the world just because they're legal terms. Niggers aren't people. Just because they're legally people doesn't mean make them friggin' people. Faggots aren't husband and wife. I don't care what the government says. If the government decrees them husband and wife, I don't care about that. They're not husband and wife. They're two fucking sodomites.
Well, that's what the church says, is live by the laws of the land. Well, the laws of the land says a man can marry a man. So go live by that.
Right. Right. But we can't accept that.
Exactly.
And I've known people that wouldn't accept it or didn't want to accept, but the language they use, the language that shows an acceptance of it. And even that's wrong.
When the statement was made to live by the laws of the land was godly at that time.
Well, right, but you can't live by the laws of the land. And that's an example that Peter and John set in Acts chapter 5, when the Pharisees commanded them not to speak the gospel and said, hey, we got to obey God rather than men. You agree with the laws of the land and live by them so far as when the laws of the land expect you to contradict the laws of God. And you don't do that. And for that, you're going to be persecuted.
He seeking his life shall lose it, and he losing his life because of me shall find it. You know, I would read that to think like you've got to put the kingdom of Christ first, because we all have ambition in this life. Like we have to work and we have to do things so that we can, so even that we can help our brethren and things like that. So I'm thinking in that respect, we do have a life in this world and where we all do have some ambition, but our main ambition is that mission we have towards the kingdom. Would that be correct? Like, I can't just put aside all ambition and just, you know.
Yeah. You know, the apostles work for a living. But you can't put hope in that work, in a career. That's why we're told to just do something simple, like work with your hands. And spend your time working and work with your hands and work a simple, honest vocation. And spend the rest of your time seeking to please God. Yeah, the apostles had to work. Paul had to make tents. So that going to work for a day doesn't mean that you're abandoning the kingdom of God. You're going to work for a day because you have to eat, right? That doesn't mean you're abandoning the kingdom. I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, well, it's just, it seems sort of subjective. Like some people, I know when it's going to be you're seeking a life in this world, when you're seeking riches or something like that from this world, you're seeking a position in this world rather than seeking a position in the next world, in his kingdom, right? But sometimes you feel like, because we still live in Babylon, we're in bondage. So it feels like you're betraying Christ a little bit. I don't know.
I don't think
like I'm sure every man, like I'm sure if a man, if I had a carpentry business, right, I would want to do really well in that carpentry business. And I would expect a lot from myself, working as much as I could to provide for my family and make things good for my family and stuff like that. And so I can help my friends and build the kingdom sort of. But where do you draw the line where, oh, my carpentry business has now become, I'm trying to get ahead in Babylon sort of thing. Like it's difficult for, I'm trying to think where I would draw the line and how I would draw the line so I could be faithful to Christ.
Well, I tell you what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't hire fucking Mexicans so I could make more money on the next house I build.
Yeah, definitely not.
I think maybe a line would be if you're ever compelled to compromise. That's a line.
Or, you know, to feel satisfied where you're at too, you know, where he's placed you. be it with riches or without riches, but be satisfied where you're at.
You know, Ecclesiastes is a real good place to point people for that message. A man should celebrate God and thank God that he could keep the work of his own hands and enjoy the work of his own hands.
Yep.
Paul writes to Timothy and he says, with shelter and food and these things, we should be satisfied.
Yes, and those things aren't going to make me intellectually satisfied. I'm still going to spend my time pursuing knowledge of the scriptures and history and things like that, but they will make you satisfied so that you can be content with that. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, we should only need so much money and spend the rest of our time pursuing the kingdom. And if we make enough money, then we should be content. And we would have spare time to pursue the kingdom. So how much money does a man need working? Do you really have to work 7 days a week, Joe? Probably not. So you need to take that Sabbath.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a question that came to me during the week, actually. You know, because I'm here with you guys one day a week. And I have to keep doing it. I have to have that day for...
Yeah. Regardless of whether you could... I'm sorry, go on.
Sorry, Bill.
I was going to say, regardless of whether you could build a house in that day and make more money or something, build cabinets and make more money. Yeah, why work 7 days a week when working 5 or 6 days a week gives you enough to pay your bills and feed you?
God has to have a place in our lives. We have to make a place for God in our lives, I guess, in some ways, you know, to honor him.
Absolutely.
You know, I know when COVID shut the world down, that was the most peaceful time I'd ever spent.
Mm. But you're still here and you're still doing what things you need to do, right?
Right. But it was very peaceful. There was no traffic. Everything was shut down, and it was just a feeling of peace.
I get what you're saying.
Having that time in your life that for God, that's like you're building the temple. That's like you're making a place for God in your life. And you have to do it. Like, God can't. It's a choice you have to make to give God a place in your life, because God's given you that's within your power. You can choose life or you can choose the world. A lot of people out there lost in the world 7 days a week, years and years on end. They'll be in their entertainments, they'll be in bars, they'll be in, there's no time for God in their life at all, and it's all vanity. It never comes back to a Sabbath day. You know, I think that's why a Sabbath day is really important, or just making time for God in your life, a place for God.
Joe, they're addicted to it too. That's the bad part. I mean, it's worse than a drug. Entertainment is worse than a drug.
Yeah, that's how they plan 7 days a week. They plan 7 days a week of going to bars and, you know, going on holidays and every day for years and years on end. I just can't imagine it when you like, there's these YouTube vloggers and stuff like that. That's every day. There's no time for God at all in their lives ever.
Yeah, it's stories where they was having to take some of the kids and have them counseled because they couldn't do their daily routines, playing ball and soccer, hockey, and all that bullshit. and they had to go get counseled because it was mentally affecting them.
You know, if you ever look at the stands at a British or English soccer game, I mean, they're big stadiums that probably have, I don't know, 75,000 people. And it's virtually the entire stadium when they pan around is white people. But you know the population of that big city. It could be London or Manchester or whatever. It's certainly not a majority. Well, it could be half white. If that, they don't go to those games. They don't pay those ridiculous prices. It's all these other races. You know, and it's half niggers on the field or more. And the stands are just packed full of white people. It's all white faces.
Well, it said in the Bible, the world would wander after the beast. And that's what they're doing.
If you don't make time for God in your life, where are you going to end up? You know, should it really be a surprise that they end up race mixing and all kinds of bullshit because they just keep going down that same path indefinitely? It's just what, you know, Monday's a party, Tuesday's a party, Wednesday's a party, 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 and they never come back to God. And so should we be surprised that their life just goes off the rails and they're now in Guyana? And they die in hell because of their sins. You know, they die in the trials of this life, like it's saying here.
Yeah, it often leads them to ruin.
Slay the soul in Guyana. Fear he who is able to slay the soul and body in Guyana. Well, they have no fear of God. So they're just going to end up slayed in Guyana.
You know, if you want to bring a nigger or another race into your house to marry your daughter, if he wakes up at 2 a.m. and chimps out and kills everybody in the house, that is your punishment, you know, when they mix with them.
Almost everyone in our countries is just living a life of vanity. They're living in Guyana. Like, how come it's like we're living in hell? Like, most of, like, we can bear it because we have our faith, but like, this is hell. Like, our countries have just become Guyana almost.
Bill, do you want me to continue here?
No, we can kind of hear David, but we'll I think we'll probably have a little more to talk about the end of Matthew chapter 10 next week. There's some things we just glossed over, I think, but I'll give it a review before next Wednesday.
Okay.